Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome, everybody, to another special edition of the Motorsport Magazine podcast. This is part of our 100th anniversary centenary series that marks a very special year in the history of the original racing magazine. To celebrate motorsport hitting the magic ton and its founding as the Brooklands Gazette in the summer of 1924, we'll be bringing you a special podcast every month throughout this year. We'll be inviting some gilt-edged motorsport heroes and longtime friends of the magazine to relive the key moments of their racing lives and allow us a glimpse of what motorsport, both the way of life and the magazine, has meant to them through the decades. I'm your host, Rob Widdows, and today my special guest is Damon Hill, the 1996 Formula One world champion.
Right.
So I was talking about the centenary of Motorsport magazine. And right. I was thinking,
amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
100 years of I mean, what's 23? So you're a bit late out of the gate there, weren't you? Because the car had been around for at least 20 years.
yes. However, we got going in the summer of 1924.
Right.
And I think that Dennis Jenkinson spent quite a lot of time with your father because he was always rushing up and down the pit lane.
Yeah.
Getting all the best information. What are your memories of either the magazine or Jenks or both?
I grew up with all these journals around the house, and I'm sure that I didn't read them. I was too young, and I was more interested in Evel Knievel or something like that. And I can only say that, you know, that was the way that people got all their information in those days, wasn't it? Through either the Autosport or Motorsport News. I don't know if it was Motorsport News was around, but it was some sort of paper thing as well. And yeah. So this would have been an important way to get all the info you needed as an aspiring racing driver before I was born, obviously. But there was pictures I've seen just recently. I saw pictures of him on the pit wall when he was with Lotus, I think at Le Mans, and Dennis Jenkinson is there in front of them. You've got all those photographs, so you know what I'm talking about. But
I do.
It's amazing, isn't it, when you see there.
Yeah.
And Roebuck told me a story once about Jenks spotting this guy at Le Mans who was working as a mechanic, and how he nonchalantly strolled out into the pit lane when the car arrived and filled it up. And he was everyone else was running around like a mad thing. And he was taking his time, and then he kind of wandered back. So he went and found this chap and asked him, you know, you seem very calm about everything. And he said, yes, well, I've timed how long it takes to change the wheels, and I've got all the time in the world to fill up the car with petrol. So that was my dad. So that's how I think they kind of must have bumped into each other.
Absolutely. Yes. They would have bumped into each other a lot, as you well know from your career, because you were chased around by journalists a lot. Tell me, what was your attitude overall to the media in your heyday?
I just want to add one more on Jenks, because when I started racing bikes, I started racing with the Vincent Velasset Owners Club. And he used to go around Cavill Park in his racing overalls and 11ers, and I think it was a sidecar he raced, and that's how I spotted him, and I thought, I recognize that bloke with a beard. Complete maniac. I mean, you know, he really did he practiced what he wrote about. Yeah. You know, he actually was a racer and a risk taker,
yeah,
as we know from the media. But you know, it's extraordinary what a character he was. Always in his barber jacket or his what are they called? They're not barbers. They're the other manufacturer of wax cotton. Sorry, he looked filthy the whole time. It was covered in grease and it's probably just wax.
Anyway. He was a bit like you, really, because his heart really was in bike racing, which of course is where yours was originally.
Billstaff is the brand name I'm looking for.
That's right.
Yes, bike. So yeah, I came from the bike racing. So the thing that lit my fire was the pictures of people on motorbikes. I grew up around cars. I really didn't. They just didn't appeal to me for some reason. I mean, maybe it was because of familiarity or whatever. I just never looked at a racing car and thought, wow, look at that. But then the moment I saw a motorbike, I was off. I just loved them. And I loved what they looked like when they cornered. And I loved the guys that raced them. And that's what excited me.
Yeah, absolutely. how do you think that the life of a racing driver has changed? I mean, nowadays, an engineer has such an important role. And do you think in a way there's too much control coming from the pit garage rather than in the car?
I think it's a lot of control that is necessarily implemented during a race, because these cars need mollycoddling, and not the drivers so much, but the cars and the tires need to be looked after to ensure that they're within the window for their strategy. And so, yeah, the kind of finger to the wind kind of estimation of what will work and what won't, that's gone out of the window completely, because it once you know, it's one of those problems, isn't it? Once you know, once you have the information, you'd be mad to try something different. Yes. Because, you know, the odds of anything else working, it's all been calculated 1,000,000,000 times, literally millions of times. They do. I was talking to Bernie Collins, who's one of our strategists on the Sky. She's now jumped ship and become a commentator. But, you know, you talk to this, they run strategy millions of times. Mm. I mean, within that, how are you going to find anything unusual? You know, it's almost, there's no scope for we're going to start on, I suppose there is still a little bit of a window with the suck it and see when it comes to wet weather and raining and whether or not you're going to take a chance. There is still that. That's very difficult to predict on a simulator, but otherwise they sort of know what their best outcome is before they start, and the driver has to just stay within that window. I mean, you ask the question, how has it changed from the work point of view? The feedback, the data logger was the driver, and the way that the driver cared for the car in the past was very, very important. And if they were too rough, the car would break and wouldn't make it. And they had to feel their way through things, and with limited feedback other than the pit board, you know, as to how things were going. So quite a big difference operationally from the car, the driver on the track. But I think also the mind of the driver, the personality of the driver has changed a bit, because you can reasonably expect if you start karting at age 4 or 3, you know, you've got a chance of getting to Formula 3 and then you've got a career path. Well, that was never the case in the past. It was simply fancy having a go, yes, and it was done for the love of it. And if you were good, you just had to jack in your job and go and run off with a circus. And that was a huge gamble career-wise, apart from the risk, obviously. So they're kind of different. Approach to life, perhaps.
And you, as a driver, would you be totally comfortable with the way things are now, or did you actually prefer having more to do yourself as regards looking after the car and maybe seeing the black clouds coming?
Yeah. Much preferred doing my thing and, you know, set up and stuff. I thought I could find an advantage, you know, by not being too crazy with things and, you know, using the setup and setting the car up to help me, you know, a bit like Alan Prost did and Jackie. And, you know, you can get the car to help. It's a tool or an instrument is probably a better way to describe it. And so you'd want to tune it and play with it so that it suited your way of driving and you could get the car to adapt to you. Now the driver has to drive the car the way the engineers say is quickest, which is, I would think, very difficult to do for some people. I mean, it's just within certain, I mean, human characteristics, some people have got a certain way of driving and other people have got another way of driving. And I don't know, I might be wrong, but it seems to me like they're just obliged to drive it the way the engineers say they've got to drive it, which I would find perhaps a little frustrating. I mean, I tried driving like other drivers sometimes. It didn't work for me. I had to drive the way I drove.
In your role on TV, on Sky F1, who's impressed you in the modern era? I mean, what did you make, for example, of Verstappen's season? As ever, best man in the best car, or...?
No, I think it's easy to look at the results and say, well, that must have been relatively straightforward. There were so many opportunities for him to drop the ball, and he didn't. It was an unbelievably polished season, you know, in terms of his delivery of the potential of the car. And he's still out there on the limit, you know, he pushing the car and getting the maximum out of it. And the team gave him the wherewithal, but, you know, it was an amazing performance. There's no question what we saw from Max last year was the very highest level of driving, perhaps not the highest level of racing because he didn't have to do too much of that, but you know, but we know what he can race like. So astonishing, really. I mean, really, really good stuff. I mean, you can't compare today to years gone by because the reliability wasn't there in those days. So, you know, with the regulations designed for efficiency and reliability, well, of course the cars all finish, you know, nearly all of them finish. So, you know, your luck is with you, let's say, in that regard. I mean, you know, you'd be lucky if you finished 2/3 of the races in the old days.
Talk a bit about Damon Hill. You were the first son of a world champion to become a world champion. And it's appeared to me in recent years that you seem to be now taking a greater pleasure in embracing Graham's legacy, whereas I think there was a period when maybe that wasn't so apparent. But is this true or not, really?
No, I think it's simply that I was focused on, I mean, it was always part of my mission's not the right word, but I mean, you know, part of my consciousness was that I wanted to do the name proud, you know, and carry my dad's name and his helmet and all the rest of it. And I was proud of that link. You know, I think Jacques was very different. Jacques was keen to disassociate himself and stand apart and stand alone. And that's all well and good. Maybe Nico's the same, but because I lost my dad, maybe when I was younger, and I just felt that he lost out on, or we missed out what he could have done after racing. You know, that the team was on the edge of being a very serious team and competitive team, and Tony Bryce was a brilliant driver, a young driver, and it all looked like it's pointing the right way. And maybe my dad's team would have been, you know, the Williams of the next couple of decades, you know. So I felt part of my mission was obviously me and doing what I could do, but also to not forget that it's, which is why when I won my first race, I dedicated it to, you know, Hill's past, present and future, because I you know, it does, it's important to recognize your legacy, you know, the thing that's been left to you, you know, the opportunity that's been left to you as well. So, yeah. And he was a character, you know, he had lots of good traits. He was a tough man and very determined character, but my God, look at his racing record. It's astonishing. You did a fabulous reflective piece on him that must have been an anniversary, and I think it was Quentin Spurring or someone had written a piece about the number of cars he'd driven and all the places he'd raced around the world. And it was just astonishing when you think how difficult it was to travel in those days and communicate. It was just unbelievable. He'd been everywhere and raced everything. So they're, you know, they really were so adept and versatile in those days.
In the cars he raced, filled up the entire grid when Goodwood Revival did a tribute to him.
Yeah.
And you only had to look at that and realize what an incredible story it was.
Yes, incredible. And they would, because they were a bit like jockeys, really. They people said, would you, you know, want to ride my filly in the Newmarket 10:30 or whatever it's, I'm not very familiar with horse racing, but it's like, you know, so these jockeys fly around the country, jumping in and out, jumping on and off horses. And the same, you know, they were like that. You know, John Coombs would say, got a Jaguar, do you want to drive that? And my dad would write down what he got paid by each drive and how much of the prize money is. Because they lived from hand to mouth. You know, they each gig was a bit like being a dispatch rider.
Oh, different days. My goodness me. Amazing. Mm. In your book, Watching the Wheels, you write very articulately and interestingly about Graham. And I wondered, were his achievements actually a bit of a burden for you on your way to Formula One and to the World Championship?
How can I answer that? I don't know any different. And it's really, a lot of it is, you know, I'd be guessing what was in the minds of others. I don't know what was in the minds of, you know, I read write-ups. And if you're a journalist writing about me, let's say John Webb saw the PR potential for one of his Winter Series Formula 4 2000 events. He thought, well, there's an easy win for PR. So he put me in a car. You'd have to say that was not in my best interest, but he certainly got loads of PR for his event. But it gave me an opportunity in a window. So without the name, I wouldn't have got that perhaps. So, but it taught me something, which was you have to, I like this. I like the line from the Bob Dylan song. I know my song well before I start singing, you know, so you got to do a lot of prep before you show your hand. And I had to go back to the drawing board really with that one, my career. But you know, the name was in that sense was a burden, because everyone would notice your mistakes, and they would notice when you if you're doing things wrong in the formative years. And then perhaps people are nervous of getting involved because there's an added complication to the name. It might bring, you know, people didn't want to be seen perhaps to be putting a driver like me in the team just because of my name. So I was very conscious that results would determine everything. You know, if you get good results, what can anybody say?
Yeah,
you know, it doesn't. And that's always the load bearing part of the structure, isn't it? If you've got race wins, you've got pole positions. Yeah. What more do you need to know?
Yeah. I'm thinking that when you were working on the active program at Williams, that was really a huge break for you. What was it like working with Patrick and Adrian in those days as the test driver?
Well, I thought it was fantastic. I couldn't believe my luck. You know, I'm there working in a sanctum of the most successful at the time team. And I'm getting all this, you know, direct from the horse's mouth stuff from Patrick and from Frank. I mean, Frank was, be honest, Frank was not terribly forthcoming with information. Patrick was much more outspoken, and you knew where you stood. So that was much more straightforward. But I just hung on his every word. I mean, because it was like manna from heaven for me. I just thought, wow, I can't believe this. You know, I'm here with Patrick and I'm hearing him think. He was amazing. He had his little notebook, and he was all over everyone's jobs. You know, he'd come and tell you, you'd be thinking long and hard strategically about how to approach a weekend, and he'd come and tell you in 10 minutes exactly what it is you need to focus on. So he was thinking about my job as well as everyone else's.
I described it as a huge break for you. Is that right?
Oh, completely. I mean, it was one of those things where just the clouds opened and suddenly I was kind of wafted up to this special cloud where everything I needed to know, everyone wanted to have, was available. I mean, I did hang around a lot, I'll be honest. I did go knocking on the door and became a little bit of a pest. They didn't forget me. But you have, again, you have to deliver results. And whether it was the testing or whether it was Informa 3000, things came together at the right time. And then Nigel did his wonderful stomping off to America routine. And there was a gaping great hole with my name in it, ready for me to just slot in.
Did Nigel take much interest in the active program? I'm asking you because I've often heard that, you know, he was a fantastic racer, but I don't think he was very keen on that active setup, was he?
I think people, particularly Nigel, because he'd worked or done a little bit of work with the Lotus active suspension and he knew how temperamental it was, not to say dangerous. You know, so the good thing about the Williams one was that it was, if it failed, it had a failsafe. It was more of a platform than a fully active system. And I'm sure Paddy wouldn't mind me saying, but, you know, so he was quite happy for me to do all that risky stuff, I think, testing it. And it wasn't until he had full confidence in it that he went for it. But he had as a driver, the thing about Nigel was, when he left the pit lane, he was 100% committed to everything he was doing, making that car go. And, you know, he'd never sort of tentatively go around the track and just feel his way, as far as I could tell. But, and also big misconception about Nigel was that he was a brute in a car. He was, but he also had incredible finesse and feel and talent, and, you know, a talent, sheer talent, really.
Yeah. Interesting. You got the drive in the middle of 93. There was a lot of speculation about it, obviously, and there was a media campaign, Give Damon the Drive. Were you aware of all of that?
I think, sort of, I think. Yeah, I mean, I think I remember reading that, and that was encouraging. But I knew also that Frank, if you push Frank, he's not going to do what you want him to do. So I was a little bit nervous about that, honestly. You know, Frank would be wary of any kind of media frenzy. You know, he certainly didn't respond to, you know, people power. He's not interested in that at all.
Do you remember the moment when he told you you've got the drive?
I do. I remember that I got a phone call. I knew that I was in line for it, and I was also now in limbo because one of the other drives that was on offer with Ligier had kind of been taken up, and they phoned me to say that they'd gone for someone else. I'm no worse off than I was before, because I was just a test driver anyway. So, you know, and then I got a call from him saying it was along the lines of, with much deliberation and with a bit of pushing from the engineers, we decided to give you a chat. And actually, what he said on the phone, he said, "Can you come up to the factory?" You know, he didn't say you got the drive. He said, "Can you come up to the factory?" So I said, "It's Friday night, 5 o'clock Friday night, Frank. You know, I better be worth it to drive from Wandsworth all the way up to the Didcot." And so he said, "No, I think you'll find it would be in your interest to turn up." So I duly turned up about 3 hours later, you know.
It was a good thing you did, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, so you're partnering Alain Prost in the best car on the grid. What did you learn from Alain that time?
Oh, I think I just watched what he did. I think he was as uncertain about the active cars. Most drivers were, you know, they hadn't got any experience of them. He didn't give much away. He played his cards close to his chest. But I thought here's a guy who, he's smart. He was so smart. He just literally fettled away and whittled away at getting a feel for the car and what he liked. And he didn't really go in there with guns blazing, trying to change anything. He just wanted to settle in, find out if he could get that feeling he wanted, and then he just do his thing. And he was astonishing, you know, just so quick and so effortless. But someone who made tiny iterations, tiny adjustments to things. I sometimes thought he made adjustments just to keep the engineers happy, and then he put it back again and he didn't really change it. He just drove it.
Yeah. I mean, bearing in mind that, I mean, you didn't know this at the time, but you were on your way now to your world championship. Mm. Could you see things with Alain that made you realize why he stood out?
Well, I mean, going into that situation, I was a huge Prost fan anyway, as far as his style of driving and the way he won with a minimum of fuss. So I liked his way of going about things. And so I just knew that whilst he'd had a year off, so I knew that we weren't getting the best of Alain. We weren't seeing the peak Alain. But at the same time, I thought, well, if I can get close to Alain Prost, then that's a bit of a feather in your cap. And I did on occasion, so I was quite proud of myself after that. And it was good to have that benchmark. I'm not sure that was the ultimate test. I think probably Senna would have been the ultimate test, but it didn't last long enough.
No, I was going to ask you about that. I mean, going alongside such a mercurial character, such a fiercely determined character, must have been a very different experience. Okay, same team, but a very different experience from Alain Prost.
Yeah, and especially as I knew that there was this antipathy towards Alain that he had, and I had my own views about Ayrton's approach to racing, which I thought was at times overly aggressive and sometimes bordering on reckless sometimes, you know, and particularly thinking of crashing into Alain and Suzuka. I didn't approve of that kind of thing. So I was conscious that here's this very much revered, legendary status driver who is totally no holds barred, uncompromising. But again, a great opportunity for me to find out more about myself, you know, with against someone like him, and to learn from him as well. So it was all positive, and he was perfectly charming to me in the short time I had to race with him. And but the temperament was very different, you could tell. I mean, you know, but a lot of what he discussed was between Frank and him and Patrick, and not really with me so much.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, that was one hell of a situation after Imola for you. And it's strange because Graham did the same at Lotus when Clark was killed.
Yeah, these are really bizarre coincidences. I mean, it's all you think you can say is, you know, that my dad's first win after Jim died was in Spain, and I won the Grand Prix in Spain after Ayrton had died as well. But you know, that's just one of those odd coincidence things. I'm not Graham Hill. You know, my dad. He went through the woods picking up bits of Lotus, you know, and telling the mechanics what to do after that race. And you know, I've seen photographs of him. You know, he's in an ashen face and awful scenes in the woods with journalists and policemen. It was grim. And so, you know, he had a particularly strong character. They all did in those days. They had to carry on. So it wasn't quite the same, I don't think, with my situation and his. I was definitely shaken by, not by what had happened, but by, there seemed to be a kind of plague, or not plague, but we were visited by so many scary accidents in this a very short space of time. And that's what freaked me out. Was I was thinking, it's never been like this. Suddenly it's like it was raining accidents and fatalities and serious injuries. And that's what really made me spooked, I think. Was I was trying to think, well, shouldn't we be doing something about this? You know, of course Max did do something. He and the drivers, we perhaps overreacted with some of the tires and the various chicanes that we put in, but it was that knowledge that my dad had worked hard, as had Jackie, with safety in the sport, and I stepped up and was a director of the GPDA and worked with Charlie on whatever we could do with circuits. And you know, I made sure I did my bit to be responsible as a driver in the coming years. But there's no way you can make it completely safe. But of course, things did happen. Things did move into the right direction. And I have to say, you can't argue against it. You know, the problem is with the halo. You look at that. At first, I looked at it and I went, "Well, God, it's ugly." Yeah. But you know, it's not as ugly as a driver without a head. You know, that's the truth, and Roman Grosjean's testimony to that, isn't he?
Yeah. Just a little bit on Schumacher Michael, and I wondered, do you think he ever thought of you as an equal? I'm thinking about.
I don't think so. I don't think so. I got the sense that he was he thought of me as he was sort of, to me, it was sort of like Goliath. You know, he was taunting everybody to say, you know, "Oh God, you sending me one of these kind of feeble contenders again? I'll just eat them alive." You know, I just felt like he didn't regard me as particularly a threat to him. At least that's the impression he gave, which is pretty effective, because I think it was bought by the media as well, by the press. They also saw his confidence and my perhaps lack of stridency as being not as effective as his personality and everything. So no, I think I don't think he did, but in Suzuka, there's a good picture of him shaking my hand after that race. And I have to say, I think I did. I think I probably went up in an estimation a little bit after that one.
See, I read what happened in Adelaide, for example, in a different way, because the tactic that he resorted to that day suggests that he was absolutely beginning to think of you as a, if not an equal, you know, a serious threat.
Well, we'll never know, but I mean, I was shocked because I was revisiting it the other day, and I noticed that he had it on the Friday. He had a massive shunt in qualifying, and so that was in Adelaide. He actually went off the track twice, in the pressure of the moment, you know, and so yeah, he was, you know, he that whole. We did put pressure on him. Definitely, we put pressure on him and Benetton. It was a pretty tight flight, and the view was, or the opinion had been that the Williams was obviously a better car than the Benetton. I'm not so sure it was. I think we were pretty evenly matched, and so, you know, I can hold my head up and say I gave him a good run for his money in those races anyway. But you know, nothing better than having a benchmark like a great like Michael, to say, well, I went up at the sharp end of the sport and competed at that level, and I was found wanting. I wasn't able to keep that up year in, year out like he could, but I matched on occasions, on my good days, I was as good as them. And that's, you know, I think given I was 30, you know, 33 or 34 or something at that time, he had 10 years on me. So we'll never know what could have happened if I'd started a bit younger.
You had a hell of a lot of holding your head up in your career, in my opinion, because I wondered, you know, you won the world championship in 1996 and Williams let you go, and that kind of suggests to me that did they fully support you? Did you feel really at home in that team?
No, I don't. And maybe it's not their job to support the driver. I don't know. I mean, I think today it's different. Perhaps the understanding of how you get the best out of people. In those days, it was sort of slightly medieval, or sort of at least Victorian stoicism, you know, was expected from drivers. Certainly Frank and Patrick were not people who expected any sympathy for anything. And so they didn't really understand if a driver needed a little bit of a little nod here and there. But this is being really a bit unfair, because Frank did give me support and Patrick did give me support. You know, it just from time to time they didn't back me when I really needed it. And that gave fuel to the other camp, you know, to against Michael. And I just didn't understand why they weren't giving out on my side rather than colluding, it seemed to me, with the opposition in rubbing my nose in it, you know. And I just thought, I didn't get that, because I thought we're fighting to beat these people. And so there were times when I didn't understand their logic. But I think to explain it, perhaps, Frank very much viewed the situation as they're his cars and he gives it to the driver and the driver's got to deliver with that. It's not his job to build up the driver or back the driver. The driver is simply an employee, which we've heard him quoted as saying before. And, you know, he's either got it or he hasn't. We're not going to put our arm around him and make him feel, you know, like he's loved. That wasn't their way.
No, certainly not. Murray Walker had a lump in his throat when Damon Hill won the world championship at Suzuka. How did you, it's the old media question is, you know, how did you feel that day, that night, the next morning? Were you euphoric or knackered or what?
No, I was euphoric, I think it's fair to say. I hadn't had much sleep. But the adrenaline helps you through that, and you don't really when I say one doesn't, I people who've won a championship or done something like this they would probably admit that at the time, it's very difficult. You know, the question is always put to the competitor, oh, how do you feel you just won the World Cup final or whatever? I mean, they haven't had time to even, you know, they're still in the race. I mean, I always say this about the post-race conference. They're chatting to these drivers. They're still in the racing car. Their minds are not in a press room. You know, you need to ask them Tuesday how they feel about it. You know, Monday you're exhausted. Tuesday you're starting to reflect and think, do you know what, I've done it. That was good. Job done. You feel that the glow of satisfaction a bit later on. Mm. And then before you know it, you're thinking about the next race.
Mm. Yeah, I asked that because, you know, well, first of all, because it isn't the day after the race. And secondly, because talk about coming up the hard way. Okay, you were Damon Hill, son of Graham Hill, but that was a big climb to get there, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, you know, I do like to think I'm a hard worker and a grafter. And, you know, if there's a mission, I did invest a lot in getting there. And but there's no other way, is there? You know, that sport does not give you things for nothing. You've got to put in the groundwork and the preparation and be 100% committed to it. The problem with it was, I suppose, is that, you know, I've also got a family and there's only so much you can keep giving and depriving other people of yourself. And you know, you don't go to people's weddings, you don't go to birthdays, yeah. Lots of life you miss out. And getting towards 40, you know, it was probably, you know, especially I think thinking about what happened to my dad, you know, he retired age 46 and then only had 6 months to live. So, you know, I think I was mindful that I'd worked hard to get that thing. And you know, I can understand Nico stopping at the top. You know, he timed it to perfection. I felt that there were still things to prove a little bit, you know, perhaps after 96. I thought there was maybe one more chance in me, and I was looking at McLaren. I wanted to drive a McLaren with Adrian because I know his car. And of course, that was a good car. That would have been a good move, but it wasn't to be. Ron gave me an offer I had to refuse. That's all in the book.
Yes, the book's great, as you know.
And I met him at Goodwood and he said, I've read your book and the passage about, obviously they always look up in the index whether I'm mentioned that someone in a book. Anyway, he must have looked up and gone, Ron Dennis, what's he said about me? And so I told the story about how I put the phone down on him and he said, I've read the story and that's exactly how I remember it. So there's no debate about it.
Well, of course, it's Sir Ron now, as you know.
Sir Ron, correct. And I'm so pleased for Ron because he really should have a knighthood. I mean, you know, his contribution was huge and his legacy will always be there. And yeah, I think he was wrongly deprived originally, you know, after the Stepney Gate episode. I think that might have hampered his knighthood a little bit, but it shouldn't have done. But that's a long story. That's another long story.
You said you thought you had something else to prove, but you were never going to do that at Arrows, were you?
Well, I nearly won a race. That was the one thing that was, yeah. So people remember that. I get the fans that speak to me about my career, they remember Hungary in an Arrows almost more than anything else. It's unbelievable. It was such a fantastic underdog day. It was just brilliant. But didn't win, but we came second. Anyway, we led for quite a long time. And that was, you know, if you're going to have stories to tell about being in competition, then that was a good one. That's out of the whole season. It was something we salvaged.
Yeah. Well, I mean, everybody loves the underdog, of course. I mean, that's partly what sport's about, isn't it, really?
But I mean, don't forget, I overtook Michael in an Arrows. He was in a Ferrari and I overtook him going into turn one. And so there was a lot of satisfaction after that.
I just wondered, you know, in hindsight, should you have taken a year out, do you think?
I don't think you can. I think it's like you've constantly got to keep sharpening your skills. If you're young enough, maybe you can take a year out. I'm astonished at some of these guys that come back, but they, you know, they would admit it's hard. I mean, maybe they're on simulators a bit more now than they would have been, but you know, you are sharpened up by competition, and to take a year out, you're really going to have a steep climb when you get back in, I think.
Okay, so you went to Jordan. You'd known Eddie for a very long time, before going to the team as a driver. What were his best and worst attributes as a team leader?
Eddie?
Yeah.
Well, he was distracted by things that he was distracted by the business politics and the money aspect of things and the media those things kind of meant a lot to him, whereas I think the teams I'd been with in the past, the teams, like, Frank, they were not interested at Williams about all of that. They just wanted to win. They just wanted their car to be best. And so, you know, there was a little bit of hopping around being interested in whether or not ITV and, you know, we're going to film you doing something on holiday or something, you know. And I mean, but Eddie's Eddie, you know, he was one of those, he's very intelligent, Eddie, but he gives the impression of being a bit scatterbrained, but he's not. He can focus on what needs to be focused on, but he's a very clever businessman as well. He knows how to get a deal done, but he spent a lot of time chasing deals, and that, I think, there wasn't the backup at the factory. There wasn't the Patrick Head there. I mean, there was Gary Anderson, but, you know, I think everyone was slightly derailed by Eddie's running around and making carnival the whole time, you know? So that was the difference, I would say, that I experienced at Jordan. And I had to kind of be the person to instill some discipline. So, you know, I did try to work on that, impress Eddie that you need to be serious about this, you know, getting the car right. There was a tendency of them to copy everyone and also go for headline grabbing lap times, you know, and you're just raising expectations only for them to be dashed the very first race, you know. So a bit of realism needed to be visited upon it. And so Eddie does say that, you know, I sort of taught them how to win. I don't know how much I did, but I certainly think there was something I brought to them which helped.
And you did win, famously.
I did win. Yeah, which was an astonishing race. Anyone who's interested in sitting down watching TV for 5 hours. One race, it went on not quite as long as Canada, but it was nearly as long as that. Talk about cold and wet, bloody hell.
How bad? Well, I mean, I watched it on TV there was zero visibility as far as I could make out on a pretty dangerous circuit. How bad was it?
Ridiculous. I mean, I overtook Jarno Trulli coming up from Stavelo. I just saw spray, and the next thing I know, I'm bouncing off of the side of his tires. And he must have thought, what are you doing? And I haven't seen him. I'm coming past, and I just can't see. And I just literally just nudged him gently. He never mentioned it afterwards. So, but if he's out there, I didn't do it deliberately, mate. But it was just like that. You couldn't see a thing. And so you're literally driving on the seats of your pants, and that's all you can do.
Okay, so not only the conditions, but you had your teammate Ralf Schumacher right behind you. Now, what were their team orders, and if so, what were they?
Yeah, there were team orders, but they were my team orders. Because there weren't any team orders. And so I'd done all the way I looked at it was I'd done all the hard work. I qualified ahead of Ralph. I led the race and done all of that. And and when it came to the safety car, I just thought, well, that's a bit unfair. He's right up my chuff now. And, you know, well, if we have to race for this, then it's in these conditions. And he'd never won a race, you know, Eddie's never won a race before. He's got a chance of a 1-2. And I'm just thinking, where's the bloody instructions? Come on, guys. What, you know, are you just going to sit there and let us battle it out and risk losing everything? And it was deathly silent. So eventually I came on the radio and said, Eddie, what, you know, what do you want us to do here? And my advice is tell Ralph not to do anything silly. Yeah. And we'll get this one over the line. But if anyone was in any doubt, when it came to the restart, I did not assume that Ralph would not race me. And in any case, he had John Lacey right behind him. So we didn't have room to muck about anyway. So I went off like a scolded cat and I didn't see him after that, except on the podium. He wasn't very happy.
Were you thinking at this time, were you thinking, look, I really don't need to do this anymore?
Yeah, I think after that race, I just thought, oh my God, don't ask me to do that again. I really thought, do I really want to be doing this? That was stressful. That was quite a long thing. And I think that it kind of answered a question for me, which was, I can do it, but how many more of those have got in the bag, you know? Probably not that many.
Which brings us to your retirement. Finally. Mm. How do you deal with that when you've led such a hyper tense, hyper exciting, at the top of a, you know, top level of sport? How do you deal with waking up and thinking, God, you know, what do I do now?
Well, I had to take the kids to school, so we were still pretty busy. And four children by then. So moved back to the UK, got back into life before Formula One, really, and tried to anyway, and give my kids an as normal as possible experience of dad being around. Because as I said, with my dad, he retired and then he wasn't around. So I was very keen that I could help out with Georgie and raising our children. And we had, you know, many happy years doing that, running around Surrey doing school pickups. But wouldn't have missed it for the world. So you're right, though. I mean, you need if you're used to chasing the hare, like a greyhound since as long as you can remember, to not have the hare to chase anymore was a bit of a problem, because you know, you do ask very profound questions, what you're supposed to do with your life, you know, and that can lead down a rabbit hole. I'm talking about hares and rabbits here. I'm mixing the metaphors, but yeah. But hares don't live in rabbits, do they? Live in holes, I mean. Anyway, I read a lot. You know, I spent a lot of time thinking and reading. Yeah, it can be quite difficult to decouple yourself from decouple yourself from the relentless quest for victory or whatever it is, you know. And I think a lot of sports people find that a problem. And they end up doing something ridiculous, you know. And we've lost quite a lot of drivers after their career doing something reckless, because they need to fill that void.
Yeah. Let's end on golf.
It appears
that you spend quite a lot of time playing golf, and that you are pretty good at playing.
No, I'm not pretty good. I am. You have to factor in the result, and divide that by the amount of hours spent trying to perfect it. And I think I'm probably the least productive golfer that's ever walked the earth, because I must have hit millions of golf balls, and I still can't do it, and it just drives me nuts. And but it's a diversion. It's a competitive. It's a, what's the word? It's sort of therapy, you know. Because I can at least, the worst thing that can happen is I break my wrist on a golf ball or something. I don't know, you know. So it's fairly safe. I can vent all my frustration and concentration on it, and it's quite nice to be outside.
Thank you very much for giving us all this time. Thank you, Damon.
Bye. Cheers, Rob.
Cheers. Bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.